This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with Professor John Ehrenberg, author of Servants of Wealth, The Right's Assault on Equality. It's a powerful discussion chronicling the right wing's strategy to amass and protect their fortunes, wielding dangerous ideology and legislation. Stanley Aronowitz, author of Left Turn, joins us in the second part of the program for a roundtable discussion on many topics, including ways to organize a sustained resistance to war. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Freedom and democracy are two words we've been hearing from the right wing in this country for 25 years. In their quest to shore up support for the politics of wealth and privilege, the right has organized patiently and consistently by focusing on a core ideology to amass a formidable base. The right's commentary on world affairs, morality, the state, and the economy has had an overarching focus, namely to eliminate social equality as a legitimate public policy goal. Its success has resulted in one of the most dramatic, undemocratic, and insidious transfers of wealth and power in recent American history. We are delighted to welcome political scientist John Ehrenberg, author of the book Servants of Wealth, The Right's Assault on Economic Justice. A professor of political science at Long Island University, in this, his third book, he critically analyzes the rise of an ideologically coherent right. He dissects their themes of military weakness, moral decay, racial anxiety, and hostility to social welfare to reveal their central organizing objective, protecting wealth and assaulting equality.
Professor John Ehrenberg, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to write Servants of Wealth, The Right's Assault on Economic Justice.
I'm a political scientist by training and by profession. My area of specialization is ideology and political theory. So that explains a little bit about why I chose to attack this problem this way. I've been doing mostly scholarly work for these many years, and my wife has always been after me to write a clear, declarative, focused, and accessible treatment about what's been going on. And the more I thought about it and the more radical the Bush administration became, the more it occurred to me that somebody really had to account for the way in which for 25 years the right wing has managed to establish a real ideological and political and institutional base for itself. Part of the way it did that was in the realm of ideas. The left has often dismissed that by saying, well, all they had was money and all they had was brawn and we had the brains and the ideas. But that's really not what happened. And I think what we really have to take account of is that for 25 years, the right has been patiently organizing and paying close, clear attention to a distinct set of very core ideas around which it has constructed a very, very powerful movement. The core of the movement and the core of what's been going on is the upward distribution of wealth. And the United States now has the honor of being the most unequal advanced industrial nation on the planet, no matter how you measure it. This is not the result of economic growth. It's not the accidental result of the way the market works. It's the conscious, deliberate result of 25 years of social policy. And I felt I had to shine a light on that. So that's why I wrote the book.
Now, when you talk about that in the book, I guess one of the things you talk about is that that's not just the result of the free market, John, but you also talk about its relationship to the Constitution or constitutional crisis in this country. You sort of give our listeners the thesis of the book and what you're really trying to demonstrate.
The thesis of the book is that just as the creation of these vast disparities of wealth has been a political project, so is the solution to these vast disparities of wealth a political project. And as the United States comes closer and closer to being a pure kind of plutocracy in the old fashioned – the Greeks understood plutocracy as a government that was openly dedicated to the service of wealth. That's what we're becoming, and that's what's been developing for the last 25 years. As that's been happening and as the institutional base of the right narrows and narrows, it gets more and more radical. That's what's been happening certainly in the last 8 years of the Bush administration, and it's in that context that one can expect indifference to the Constitution, indifference to the rule of law, and a sense that these people really do believe that they can do whatever they want. When that's magnified by 9/11 and war, you get the constitutional crisis that we have now.
John, take us back 25 years, and how did this get started?
It starts with – in economic terms, it starts with the old crisis of Keynesianism at the end of the 1970s. And that's one thing I try to do in the book is I try to account for a long economic crisis that creates the opportunity for ideas which had formerly been marginalized to suddenly acquire traction in a new environment. And if we're all kind of older in the tooth now than we were. So if you think back to the late 1970s and what it was like under Jimmy Carter, you have this long stagflation, which really, for very clear reasons, spells the end of Keynesian economic, macroeconomic policies. And that is what opens the door to a new set of arguments about morality, about authority, about foreign policy, about the market, race, gender, which suddenly become very popular in the late 70s and early 80s.
I'm sort of simple here. Keynesian economic policy, my little bit of understanding is when things are going badly, you borrow money and you pump the economy up and give people jobs and work and Social Security and all these things. And when the economy gets better, then you pay back the debt. That's really what we're referring to?
That's part of it. That's a major piece of it. The major piece of Keynesian economics is that it is prejudiced in favor of the consumer. When Keynes tried to account for the Depression, his explanation for the Depression was not overproduction, but rather its obverse. It was underconsumption. Keynesianism tends to redistribute wealth and income downward. It doesn't do so in a radical way, but it is prejudiced in favor of large-scale mass consumption. And the large-scale mass consumers in an industrial capitalist economy are to be found in the middle and the working classes. So the Keynesian period corresponds with a general equality of social relative equality of social conditions, certainly compared to what we have now. It's a period that Paul Krugman called the golden years of American capitalism. And by the end of the 1970s, that's coming under serious attack. So when Irving Kristol at the end of the 70s calls for business to organize itself politically, he senses an opportunity to have done with Keynesianism as a macroeconomic policy. And that's what begins the turn toward markets and toward the so-called trickle-down supply side.
So it's no longer really saying let's have at least a minimal social equality through whatever trickle-down, whatever else. But it's really saying we're done with that.
We're done with it.
And what's the new theory?
The new theory is, to the extent that it is a theory, is so-called supply-side economics or trickle-down economics. And that was articulated by people like George Gilder. And that became the ruling ideology of the Reagan administration and really has been the ruling ideology of every administration since then, moderated to some extent by Clinton. That policy seeks to reward wealth. And the policy is that the richer you make, the higher segments of the population, the more the economic benefits trickle down to those at the bottom.
So that's when we really see the tax cuts, the end of the estate tax, the attacks on Social Security. All those are related to really what happened at the end of the 70s, saying if we make businesses really rich and if we make people really rich, a few of them, and the argument is we won't really make people poor, we'll let it trickle down. But,
exactly.
Of course, that's just a myth.
Exactly.
But as I understand it, what's happened has been a tremendous shift of wealth from the bottom to the top, particularly to the top, say, 1% in the last 25 years. What is the extent of this inequality now, and what direction do you see it's going in?
Well, the numbers vary from analyst to analyst, but they all agree on one thing, and it's the top 1%, but even more, it's the top 1/10 of 1%. It's the families with an average net worth of $10 million or more. When you look at the percentage of the gross national wealth that is accounted for by these particular families, it absolutely blows your socks off. And it doesn't matter, like I say, it doesn't matter how it's registered. The economic benefit, to the extent that there was any ever to this policy, has long since been exhausted. And even David Stockman, who was one of the chief supply-siders, when he was the chief of the Office of Management and Budget under Reagan, after he left in a huff because he thought that politics had come to dominate the Reagan administration, he gave this famous interview to William Grider in the Atlantic Monthly in which he said, look, supply side was always a fig leaf. He called it the Trojan horse. He said the object of supply side economics was simply to lower taxes on wealth. And the real goal of these people is to eliminate all taxes on wealth and all taxes on capital. It doesn't really have a coherent economic policy any longer. It is simply the accumulation of wealth for the accumulation of wealth's sake.
John, you mentioned in a historical context that when one understands democracy, it means that you must limit the accumulation of wealth and that this has produced some of the most powerful reform movements in our country's history. What's happening with reform?
Well, it's gone out the window for the last 25 years. Both political parties have really been complicit in this disgraceful situation, although it really was the right that carried the heavy water on this. But the Democrats have been absent as well. And this raises the question of where, if at all, a corrective is likely to be found. Historically, the corrective to these things has been through the Democratic Party, but only through the Democratic Party to the extent that it responds to social movements that originate from outside. The Democratic Party in and of itself has never been capable of a sustained democratic initiative. I think the answer here, as it was in the 1930s and as it was in the 1950s and early 1960s and as it was in the early 1970s, is to build movements from outside the political process and bring pressure to bear on the Democrats. That's historically been the way in which these periods of wealth accumulation and concentration have come to a close. And I think that is going to begin to develop in the coming period.
You call the United States a one-party state. Why do you say that?
It's effectively a one-party state in the sense that certainly for the last 25 years, which is a generation, both political parties have been pretty much unanimous behind this project. Kevin Phillips has this great description of the Democratic Party as the second most enthusiastic capitalist party in the world.
And then he also, I heard him one time say it's the capitalist's second favorite party.
Yeah, exactly.
Kevin Phillips, of course, was Reagan's chief speechwriter.
And he's become a very, very angry and very effective and very smart populist in the last 10 years.
You know, you count your blessings.
You do. A smart guy.
Yeah. Well, there's a number of people we've had on our show. You could call them traitors to their class who have seen what's going on.
Let me ask about something you said in the beginning about the relationship to presidential power. And, you know, one of the things, you know, we do on this program, of course, is talk a lot about president essentially overriding all the checks and balances of Congress or the courts, everything from Guantanamo to torture to the war in Iraq, et cetera. And I've always, of course, looked at it as sort of a decline of empire, really, and the need to take that kind of power and increase militarism and all that and military spending. Can you explain a little more what you mean by that relationship of presidential power to the upward wealth that has been created in this country?
There are several different elements of the modern right. One of them are the neoconservatives. The neoconservatives have always been strong believers in a powerful presidency. They began to coalesce around the various think tanks and study groups in the late 1970s in response to what they thought was a weak foreign policy at the hands of Jimmy Carter. To the extent that you want a vigorous, muscular foreign policy, to that extent you want a vigorous and more powerful presidency. So in part, the rise of the neocons has signaled the rise of a powerful presidency. I think, though, a lot of the connection between what's going on now and the distribution of wealth and power is a function of what's been happening in the country since 9/11. You've got a particularly focused and ideologically coherent bunch of people at the center of state power. They're organized around a set of very, very clear policy objectives, all of which require the abandonment of traditional – I mean, I think you really can start talking about kind of proto-fascism here in the sense of an abandonment of the traditional separation of powers, an abandonment of many of the kind of cardinal tenets of bourgeois democracy. So the connection between the upward distribution of power on the one hand, and the concentration of power in the hands of the presidency on the other, is that as a regime matures and as it gets more and more radical, which this one has, it tends to retreat to its areas of institutional strengths. And that's what's been going on. I think what you're likely to find is that the results of the last election will register in the legislative branch to some extent, but Bush has made it very, very clear that as far as the electorate is concerned, it will have no impact whatever on the way he conducts the war. I do think, though, with all that's said and done, that the results of the election are likely to have some long-term breaking impact on the concentration of power in the presidency, if only because there comes a point when even a strong-willed president like this guy waging a very, very unpopular war is going to have to take account of the Congress. And I think that day is not long away.
We're speaking with Professor John Ehrenberg. He's just written a terrific book called Servants of Wealth, The Right's Assault on Economic Justice. We're glad to have him here on Law and Disorder.
I don't think it's contradictory to what you were saying earlier, but what you're really sort of saying is we have to build up an outside movement of groups. And I'd like you to describe who you think those people are, what will make them up. And then you talked about the mood of Congress. The mood of Congress, you know, I do a lot of work in Congress, unfortunately, because I represent Guantanamo detainees. And, you know, I feel pretty hopeless about the issues, at least the torture issues, Guantanamo issues, the war issues. You're going to get some movement on minimum wage and a few of the other economic issues, maybe a little on the healthcare stuff. But even on the core economic issues, I don't see a big change. So while I think the election was important in a certain way, I don't see yet the members of Congress ready to move on what I think were the sentiment of the people who voted on it.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. What I meant when I said before is that elections, they're a register of popular opinion to that extent that carry some weight. But I think what this one will do is it simply will create the opportunity to raise issues that have not been on the table for the last 25 years. I have no more faith in Congress than you do, Michael.
Right. No, I didn't think you did. So.
And like you, I've spent 25 right. years being disappointed by the Democrats.
Right.
But I do think that we can now put issues on the table and get an airing for them that formerly simply were off. The right has made the central goal of its policy for the last 25 years to take economic redistribution and economic equality off the table as a legitimate goal of foreign policy or domestic policy rather. And for a long time it succeeded. You didn't have any discussion about this. Now you still don't. Even at a time, for example, when the number one domestic issue that people talk about is health care, there is not one single politician who's talking sensibly about health care.
It is remarkable.
None of them. Even at a time when economic inequality in this country is at its historic height, even more so than it was during the so-called Roaring Twenties, the only national political figure at this point who's even beginning to talk about it is John Edwards, and all he's talking about is poverty. Now, that's not to say that it's not important. There's no doubt that none of these people are talking, and like you, I think none of them are capable of talking about the bigger systemic issues. But the election does create the opportunity for us to start talking about it and for it to get in the press a little bit and for it to get on the airwaves a little bit and for it to get reflected in the halls of Congress a little bit in this kind of piecemeal way that these people are doing. And that's the way you build – unfortunately, that slow process is the way you build consciousness.
John, let's roll the tape back 25 years. The United States has just come out of a defeat in Vietnam, its first defeat after the Second World War. And what are these people thinking? And what are they going to do? And how did they put this project together?
I'm not sure they had any idea how successful they were going to be. I mean, I think that's one thing about the way in which these kinds of movements develop. Hegel has this wonderful line in the Phenomenology when he says that an idea is right. He's a historicist, right? So he says an idea is right when it successfully comprehends its era in thought. Now, when you look back at the late 70s and the early 80s and you start to see the constituent elements of the right come together, I really don't think they had any idea how successful their attack on liberalism would be.
We thought they were a joke. The Mandate for Change came out when Reagan took office, which was the Heritage Foundation, this stinky little think tank in Washington.
Exactly.
I never expected it to go anywhere. I was so appalled by Reagan and the Mandate for Change, and look what it is.
I was on the University of Wisconsin campus in the 60s. Republican Youth, I can't remember what they were called. I agree with you, Michael. We thought they were a joke.
Yeah.
Turned out, not too long after that, these people had desks in the White House.
Well, the Federalist Society started around then, and they very cleverly groomed young lawyers to move up into positions high in the government.
But one question which you said was why, John, yes, it was an idea whose time they hit right, but why? Why was it the right idea at that point? Was it the end of the Vietnam War, beginning weakening of U.S. imperialism, whatever? I don't know.
It was a lot of things, a lot of things which came together. I mean, I think all of us had a period, had a sense in the late 70s that there was something wrong. There was something that was just not right about this period, but I don't think any of us knew it until it happened later. There were a lot of things. It was Vietnam. It was the aftershocks of the great social movements of the 50s and 60s. It was the end of Keynesianism and of the New Deal consensus. All of these things came together in the ideological, political, and above all, the economic crisis of the late 1970s to produce a real possibility for a sea change. So you have these different pieces. I remember reading Jerry Falwell's book back then, and that came out in 1980. I said, who the hell is this guy? You know, who would listen to this clown? When you read his book, which I unfortunately had to do for this for my book a second time.
It's a living.
It's preposterous. It's absolutely preposterous. And yet, the moral, authoritarian, Southern-based right turns out to have been one of the enormously powerful political influences in the late 20th century history of the country.
We're speaking with Professor John Ehrenberg about his book, Servants of Wealth. What were the various pieces that they put together? It was the think tanks. It was the universities. It was the consolidation of the media. Tell our audience, John, what were these pieces that they put together to build this enormous engine of right-wing social change?
Well, what I did in the book is the story of how they put together the institutions has largely been told. What I try to do in the book, and I don't think that what I try to do in the book really has been told yet, is try to account for the ideological arguments that they put forward. Why? I mean, we were just talking about this. Why is it that a bunch of arguments that had formerly been the marginalized arguments of a backward, self-serving, narrow little right-wing elitist bunch of individuals, how come suddenly they acquire a mass base?
Well, tell us. Take a deep breath and take some time and tell us these ideological arguments are.
There are five pieces to it. And I think one could have divided this pie up in any way one wanted. I mean, the right did advance on a very, very broad front over this period of time. I chose to divide its different armies, if you want, into five constituent pieces. And I really thought these were the important ways in which we're doing it. And I want to repeat that I don't think they really had a sense of how powerful they'd be. I'm not sure how much they cooperated with each other. In many ways, this coalition that makes up the right is highly unstable and is always under threat, like all coalitions are. But there were five, I think, essential pieces. The first were the neoconservatives, who come together around a critique of what they thought was a defeatist U.S. foreign policy at the end of the 1970s. And a lot of this does have to do with Vietnam. It has to do with changes in the United Nations. It has to do with what these people falsely, it turns out, alleged to have been a menacing series of threats from the Soviet Union. The first generation of these people come together in a series of organizations, the Coalition of Peace Through Strength and a whole bunch of other ones, to demand that the old Keynesian calculus of guns and butter be recalculated. And the claim was, we can't afford guns and butter anymore. Guns are more important than butter. Butter's going to have to yield. That was the essential argument. We can't have domestic social reform on the one hand and a militantly aggressive foreign policy on the other. So the latter is more important. So that was one piece of it. Was a critique of a weak-minded, democratic-led foreign policy. A second piece of it was the rise of a distinctly Southern-based, religiously inspired right, which makes arguments about authority, about the breakdown of authority. And in particular, they made arguments about women and the breakdown of the so-called traditional nuclear family. But what really freaked people like Jerry Falwell and the likes of him out was the women's movement. And when you read the stuff they wrote about the women's movement, it's just beyond belief, the stuff that they're talking about when they describe Bella Abzug as a ranting lunatic, Betty Friedan as the ice-cold, man-hating feminist. I mean, it plays into the most appalling stereotypes. And yet, once again, for people who were threatened by these social movements, and in particular threatened by the direct challenges they posed to the old systems of authority, they resonated. One of the arguments I make, by the way, is that you can't account for the rise of the right by simply calling them liars, although many of them are thugs. You can't account for them by saying, well, they know how to frame things. You can't account for it by saying, well, the liberals collapsed. All of those things are true. And yet you don't get a 25-year period of ideological hegemony unless you can understand that it had a real mass base. And it really did. The right wing spoke to people's real fears at a time when the left had nothing to say. And even though they adopted the tactics in a sense of bait and switch, they raised real issues and then turned out to be servants of wealth, they still did say things that people responded to. So the first thing was weak foreign policy. The second thing was a breakdown of authority in the family, in society, in schools, and everywhere else. A third set of arguments pivots around race. The arguments around race and the need to discipline ungrateful, unruly blacks become very, very prominent in the late 70s and early 1980s. The claim is that equality before the law is as far as anybody should go in a decently organized society. Anything more than that is pandering to blackmail and the result of liberal weakness, and it's time to stand up to the blacks and insist that they behave themselves. Racism is dead. The right said it's time for people to hitch up their belts and get to work. Reagan invents this whole – you remember the Reagan notion of the wealthy mother on the Cadillac and the Cadillac, which was a fiction, by the way, but which totally expressed the prevailing suspicion of welfare as a government-funded handout to the parasitical, ungrateful, violent, dangerous black underclass.
What's the fourth and the fifth?
The fourth argument is an argument about the market. Fourth argument is an argument that – and this is really where the right stops being this kind of complaining backward-looking force and begins to cast itself as the forward-looking voice of economic opportunity and wealth creation and begins to say, well, it's the liberals who are the backward-looking party that's been captured by so-called special interests. So the fourth piece of it is that, hey, the market is where free people – make individual autonomous choices. They enter into voluntary compacts with each other. This is Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman and all these guys. And social policy needs to be organized around loosening restraints upon the market and letting – Reagan used to get all dreamy-eyed when he talked about, you know, the magic of the market. And this is where the supply-siders come in with their desires for deregulation and privatization and cutting taxes on wealth. And the fifth element, which emerges rather recently, is an unapologetic defense of inequality in the name of meritocracy. Well, the market rewards those who deserve it. And if you're rich in the market, it's because you work harder, and maybe you're a little bit lucky, but you've worked harder and you deserve your wealth, and if you don't work hard, you can't possibly get ahead. So there's this – and this taps into a very, very old American tradition of the independent, small property-owning entrepreneur who makes his way in the world and ends up better off than he was when he began. None of these arguments were invented in a sense. I mean, they all really play into deep American positions, the most important of which for our purposes really is a tradition of anti-statism. The notion that the welfare state is inherently corrupt, the welfare state is inherently authoritarian. If left alone, it will tax more, it will regulate more, it'll take more of your stuff and give it to people who don't deserve it. You have to rein the state in and let free people do their thing. And you hear George Bush talking about the ownership society. This was back before 9/11, in much the same terms that Ronald Reagan used to talk about a society in which his idea of a just society was one in which everybody could get rich. When a reporter asked him what kind of society he wanted to lead as president, that's what he said. The notion of anti-statism draws upon one of the facts of American social history, which is that since the 1890s, every single redistributionist, social egalitarian trend in American history has been statist, in the sense it has relied upon the government to restrain the market, redistribute wealth, police the marketplace, and follow a policy of, generally speaking, more economic equality. So if you are anti-state, I mean, the whole notion of anti-statism is interesting given Dick Cheney and Ronald Rumsfeld and George Bush's notion of the unitary president, who can do anything he wants. But you have to distinguish between ideology and the arguments that make it in the ideological sphere and then the actual policies that are pursued.
Tell us a couple of questions I have, but certainly one I want to know is how did 9/11 affect these five pieces of the what you call the right or the plutocracy's push? And how do you see it going forward that these are actually being destroyed in some way, or at least
9/11 intensifies everything. And one of the things that 9/11 does is it delays the appearance of a corrective. Kevin Phillips has this notion of these broad cycles of American history where he says you get these periods of wealth concentration, and the two that he talks about in particular are the 1890s and the 1920s. And they're followed by periods of corrective policies, which tend to be more redistributionist and tend to be presided over by the Democrats. And everybody's been asking for the last period of time, where's the corrective? This has been going on for 25 years now. Where's the corrective? And my sense is that 9/11 simply delayed the appearance of the corrective. for a couple of years. And that now maybe, and this may be, Michael, I mean, it may be that I'm more hopeful than you are that something new, some new set of policies are possible. But it's possible now that with the breaking of the ideological stranglehold that the Bush administration had on issues of terrorism and foreign policy, that it's possible that a real debate about economic matters can now be engaged in this country.
John Ehrenberg, author of Servants of Wealth, The Right's Assault on Economic Justice. You can get the book anywhere, I guess, and it's published by Roman and Littlefield. This really gives you, you know, here we're dealing with everything, some of the results, but we're not dealing with the causes. And this is really tells us what is going on in this country for 25 years when I guess John and I and the rest of us on this show, at least a lot of us, grew up in the 60s at a time when we thought there was this great possibilities for really changing the country. And in many ways, we did. Sure. And in many ways, it's been trying to reverse itself for 25 years. And now maybe we're again at the beginning of a change. So, John, really, this was a terrific interview. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
We've been speaking with Professor John Ehrenberg, who's just written the book Servants of Wealth, The Right's Assault on Economic Justice. Can these policies of the last 25 years be broken? We're going to have, and John's going to join in with us to speak with our next guest, Stanley Aronowitz, who's written the book just out, Left Turn, Forging a New Political Future. Let's talk about, now that we know what the problem is, let's talk with Stanley Aronowitz about what he thinks the solution is.
America is in the midst of a crisis of democracy as we literally descend into an authoritarian state. On Law and Disorder, we've seen firsthand the casualties of this crisis, from the growing militarization that pervades our lives to a dominant fundamentalism that cuts short critical thinking. Renowned social critic Stanley Aronowitz presents an alternative platform for our future in his recent book, Left Turn, Forging a New Political Future. As we start the new year, we can borrow from the historical traditions of the European left, as well as the more recent trends in Latin America that are challenging, head-on, the death of socialism. Stanley Aronowitz is a professor of sociology, cultural studies, and urban education at the CUNY Graduate Center. He is also a veteran political activist and cultural critic, and a passionate champion of organized labor. In addition to authoring numerous books, he is a founding editor of Social Text, a journal that is subtitled Theory, Culture, Ideology.
Stanley, welcome to Law and Disorder. Why do you think we need a new political party? What's wrong with the notion of, you know, the Democrats are going to finally do something for us? And you don't believe that. Why don't you believe that?
Well,
what do you think we should do?
Yeah, obviously, Michael, the problem at this point is not whether the Democrats will or will not do something. They are likely to do something like, for example, increase the minimum wage, and it won't be enough, or they'll perhaps even play around with some version of universal health insurance, which will be probably terribly inadequate. That's not the problem. The problem is it's a conception of how things change. Things don't change, in my view, unless there's a force outside of the mainstream of society, that is the main ruling class parties, of which the Democratic Party is one, that forces the issues that need to be changed. And I'm even speaking about reform. Then when you get beyond reform, that is when you get to the problem of fundamental change, which we need, and John's book is a very good example. That is to address the issue of the growing gap between rich and poor, about the growing corporatization of virtually every nook and cranny, every itch and scratch of society. You're not going to get that change out of the mainstream political parties. You're going to have a new political party to force that change. So on both grounds, both the grounds of reform and fundamental social, radical social change, you need a party. Now, we have a left in this country. Half of it thinks it's going to push the Democratic Party to make at least the reform changes, and the other half thinks that the only way that you can force change is by resistance and protest. Protest and resistance are very necessary, I think. We need an anti-war movement. We need a movement that defends abortion. We need a movement that protects immigrant rights. But those movements need to connect with one another if we're going to get any kind of fundamental social change. That's the function of a political party. And none of those movements makes those connections because they tend to be movements that take on specific issues and sometimes do it well and sometimes do it not so well, but they take them on as if those issues are disconnected from every other issue. What the function of a radical political formation in the United States would be is to make those connections and to show people that the war is not separate from the problem of health and education and jobs and income, and people who are fighting for higher wages and for better working conditions can't address their issues fully without addressing the issue of the war. So those kinds of things have to be done by a political party, only a political party.
We're speaking with Professor Stanley Aronowitz, who's just written the book Left Turn, Forging a New Political Future. How do we get there? What happened in the 30s when there was a huge rise of the working class in the United States, when the trade unions were formed, when even the women's movement or the black movement saw that their future went through the trade unions, when there was that kind of social consciousness? And then what happened to it and why? That's going to be my first question. Why didn't it work in the 30s? And then I'm going to ask you why it didn't work in the 60s. But answer my first one first, Stanley.
Well, the first
what happened in the
30s? The first one first has a single name. It's called the Communist Party. The Communist Party made a decision for reasons that have to do with the fight against fascism, their decision that their priority was to fight fascism and not fight for socialism or for fundamental social change. And the Communist Party made that decision about 1935 on a global level. And they decided that the big fight was to defeat Hitler and defeat fascism in Italy and in Spain, and wherever else it arose. And they decided that in order to win that fight, they had to extend their hands to sections of capital and the middle class and to reformers and to liberals. And what they did at that point is they tucked their revolutionary political ideology, they tucked it under the mattress, hoping that one day it would reemerge. And actively, in many ways, actively discouraged the formation, a new political formation, which I think was clearly on the horizon for the reasons that you just have mentioned. I don't blame them entirely. I think part of another part of the reason is that the reform-minded labor leadership, who were both friendly to and outside of the Communist Party, or for that matter the Socialist Party, got convinced that the Roosevelt coalition was as far as they could go in that period, and they decided to play in the Roosevelt or the New Deal Democratic Party-led coalition for a series of fairly substantial reforms. And they felt that if they went and became radical and stood really in some sense outside of the political system, they would get less. And I think that was a serious mistake.
And I agree with you, Stanley, and I'm going to fast forward you 30 years. We're here in the studio with Michael Ratner, a veteran of the 60s radicalization.
Hi, Stanley. How are you?
Heidi Bogosian, who's a little younger than us but knows all about it. John Ehrenberg, who's our contemporary and a veteran as well. And me, Michael Smith. And we've got Stanley Aronowitz on the line. Professor Ehrenberg is here as a kind of a guest host to interview, and he's going to shoot in with a question. But before we get to the others,
talk about the 60s.
There's the second question I had. We didn't make it in the 30s. We were all part of the movement in the 60s, and we didn't make it then. My question is, why?
Well, I think in the 60s there were, you know, it was slightly different because it was, you should excuse the expression, us, the new left. Maybe not you, Michael, either, Michael, but it was us, the new left, who decided that the movement the movements that had emerged, the civil rights, the black freedom movements, the feminist movement, the anti-war movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, the disability movements, that those were both necessary and sufficient. We decided that political parties, that partly the experience of Stalinism, that political parties were superfluous, in fact, more than superfluous, they were going to be a detriment to our forward march. And so we refused an attempt that was both within the movements, that is, within the New Left, as well as from outside, that is, of some of the small political revolutionary parties like the Progressive Labor Party and others. We refused the attempt to transform the New Left into a political formation of the kind that I've talked about.
Well, let's talk about now.
Well, now we've got a third problem, but you see, well, the third problem we have now is that the movements are much, much weaker than they were in the 1930s or the 1960s. And right now what we have is a strong, I would call it, a social movement fetish, part of which is the result of same forces that produced our refusal in the 60s, and part of which is a conscious kind of anarchist view that we don't want political parties because they'll be bureaucratic and authoritarian. And because of the weakness on the one hand and the ideological opposition to political formations itself, both electoral as well as non-electoral, we are facing the problem now of a very fragmented and a very isolated left, both isolated from the mainstream of American society, but also isolated from each other. What we need to do is get started, and I have a proposal in the book on how to get started, and it will sound very, very difficult for people, but I think it's the only way to go.
We're speaking with Stanley Aronowitz, author of the newly published Left Turn, Forging a New Political Future. The four of us are sitting here, Stanley, asking you the ultimate question, how do you get started?
Well, the way you get started is that every one of you, the four of you who are in different parts of the various movements and institutions of the left, take some time and form a study group, not only around my book, although my book is a good starting point, but around some of the classical readings on revolutionary and radical political formations. I mean Lenin, I mean Luxembourg, I mean Rosa Luxemburg and Lenin, who had a debate. I mean Marx himself in the Communist Manifesto. I mean various recent places where these issues of organization, of political organization, have been raised. Have study groups which are connected to one another, and at some point, perhaps a year from now, maybe 18 months, 2 years, have a conference and have people start to talk about what they learned at that conference or what they are hoping to learn from the history both of the American left as well as the history of the world radical and revolutionary movements in terms of the kind of political formation that we need. I think part of that reading has got to be the utopian thinking that I suggest in the last chapter. I think part of that thinking has got to be books like Michael Albert's Paracon, like Gar Alperovitz's Beyond Capitalism, Seymour Melman's After Capitalism, and even the history of utopian thinking that goes back to the 19th century.
Stanley, let me ask you a question. This is John Ehrenberg.
Yeah.
I should say at the outset that I came out of a different trend in the 60s left than you did. I actually was part of a Marxist-Leninist party-building attempt for many, many years. And I, like you, I was in this for like 15 years. So I was never a fan of the anarchistic social movement-y kind of orientation of the new left. And I actually didn't ever define myself as a new leftist precisely for that reason. We tried to make our connection to the old working class history of the properly speaking American left. So I agree with you thoroughly about the need for an organized political apparatus that can raise these general questions and speak in a comprehensive way and provide a context within which all of these particular and narrow and individual struggles can be carried on and understood. But having said that, I have to confess to a healthy skepticism about this at this point, and I want to ask you this question. People who talk about the need for a third party.
I'm not talking about a third party. Go ahead.
All right. Well, let me rephrase it.
I'm not talking about a third electoral party as the basis anyway. You should. I mean, in the book, I argue against the focus, the primary focus, I mean, on electoralism. That's not what I'm interested in. And I think that would be a mistake.
All right. So tell the listeners how your notion differs from the old notions of a third electoral party.
Because it's based on a much older radical tradition, which says that out of the social movements, that is, out of the workers' movement, out of the the feminist movement, out of the freedom movements, the Black and Latino and other kinds of freedom movements, has got to come a sense of coordination and of connection. It's got to come out of the groundswell, or at least out of the base of the political of the movements. But the difference between me and the movement fetish is that I would argue that they have to form, they have to develop a political formation. Now, what would the political formation do? I mean, it would be a formation that would fight for health care and fight for various changes in the society, but it would fight for it in an organized fashion. It would fight for it by making connections, and first and foremost, it would fight for it by creating a weekly and finally a daily newspapers, various kinds of publications, books and magazines and pamphlets and everything else, a large educational effort to convince people, the American people and the left itself, that social change is not only desirable but necessary. Now, what we don't have in this country that we had in the 60s, one of the reasons I think we didn't have a party is because we had a National Guardian. We had The Guardian. And it was a weekly newspaper. I don't mean The Nation, which is a left liberal magazine of opinion. I mean, we had a weekly newspaper. We had, in the teens of the 20th century, we had dailies. Even in the 30s, you had The Daily Worker. You can't do that without a political formation unless you have rich people.
Stanley, let me interrupt you a second. One of the problems that I've seen in the last 10 years is that we have, say, several anti-war groups, and there's a lot of infighting, to be quite honest. There's competition. I don't know whether the internet has helped foment this with, internet campaigns and going after the same funders. How would you deal with that?
Well, I'm not interested in funders.
Well, I mean, competition with an ideology.
My proposal is that 25,000 people put up between $5, $10, $15, $20, $100, $200, $500, put it out of their own pocket, no funders to speak of. I mean, I wouldn't turn down funders, but essentially this has to be people taking money out of their own pocket and saying, we need a national newspaper to start with. I mean, this is, why don't we have a national newspaper? It's because people are interested in individual movements. So because they're interested in the Democratic Party, they got a National Democratic Party newspaper. A magazine of opinion. It's called The Nation. Every time you turn around and say, we need a new political formation, people like Van den Heuvel and others at The Nation say, no, that's terrible. We don't want that. What we have to do is change the Democratic Party. We need a formation. Because without a formation, we're not going to be able to provide the kind of news as well as the kind of, I mean, it would be online as well as hard copy, the kind of news as well as the kind of agitation as well as the kind
Stanley,
of
Stanley, one second. This is Michael speaking. I'm interested in John's opinion about this because I don't know if he really chimed in here about whether, I mean, I know you don't necessarily believe we're working within the Democratic Party and you believe you have to push it from outside, but you agree with Stanley?
I'm not pushing it from outside.
No, I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about John. I wasn't talking to you, Stanley, I was talking with John about it. I'm just interested in John's thoughts about your views, not just about the newspaper, about these Democratic formations and whether that's a way to go.
I think that Stanley's absolutely right. We need some kind of political way of thinking that can enable all of these isolated social – and they are awfully isolated, not just from each other, but they're isolated from the general population as well. We need a way of enabling them to talk to each other and to talk to the general population. And the way to do that is the only sphere of thought and action that makes that possible is politics, because it focuses on the general issues. And this goes all the way back to Aristotle. So when I listen to Stanley talk, I'm reminded of Lenin. Lenin proposed building the party around the newspaper. There's a very famous moment in the 1905 revolution when Lenin is talking about this mass revolution in 1905 that featured spontaneous workers' strikes and factory occupations. It featured peasant risings. It featured student demonstrations and strikes and sit-ins and whatnot. And Lenin addresses, in Pravda, Lenin addresses the question, how are we going to get all of these different elements to talk to each other? Now, this is a time when the Bolsheviks are pretty weak and pretty isolated. And he says the way to do it is you have to conduct the kind of agitation and propaganda that will enable students to understand that supporting workers is in their immediate direct interest. and in which peasants had to be made to understand that students' demands for democracy on campus is directly in the interest, in the self-interest of the peasantry. Now, there's only one way to do this, Lenin said, and that is you've got to focus upon the state, the nature of the state, and the requirements of political democracy. And that's – now, he wasn't talking from the standpoint of the leader of a strong, powerful party, but what he was saying was that the only – political apparatus which can do this is an apparatus that is rooted in the working class, because only the working class can really raise these issues in the broad, comprehensive way that is necessary. The problem I had with what Stanley is saying is that, and I think this is the central problem the left needs to address, is the so-called question of agency. Who's going to do it?
Yeah, it's, well, look,
at
you
a
know,
time at a time when the organized working class is least organized and least developed and least politically powerful in the last 50 years. So, and I think that's something that left has to do. I love Stanley's notions, and I love these ideas of getting people to think politically and organize themselves. But, you know, when Irving Kristol in 1979 said to business, you got to think politically, and you got to organize newspapers and conferences and think tanks and whatnot, he's speaking to people who actually had a mass institutional base and actually had somewhere to go with all this, and they did it, and they ran with it. I'm not sure, Stanley, frankly, that we're in this kind of position at the moment. And I think this question of the relationship between the social movements and the Democratic Party remains an open question.
Stanley, your response?
Yeah, John, look, the only thing, my short answer is it's never a good time. It was not a good time in the 30s. It was not a good time in the 60s. It's never a good time. There are always people, and well-meaning people, and people with good, solid arguments who will say, the movement's too weak, the working class is too weak, this is not the time. I agree with you, but it's not. And I would have to, I'm not a Zionist at all, but I'll have to go back to a very old phrase, if not now, when? No. Let me just finish. If you don't have an organized and you have to read the book. I'm sorry. It really is important that you do that, because I talk about the working class. I talk about the labor movement, and I'm going to make an argument that, and I make an argument which says you're not going to have a strong labor movement in the United States without a detachment of that labor movement being this political formation of which we speak. We're not going to have a revival of the feminist movement for the same reason. You can't depend on spontaneity. You got some good unions, bad unions, and different unions, but the difficulty is that those unions are under essentially a business leadership right now, and there are exceptions, but not many. And I would say if you don't have a serious rank-and-file movement in the labor movement, and that rank-and-file movement has to come out of political formation. It's really, unless it becomes a factional movement, which is true of a number of the places, you're not going to have a strong labor movement. You're not going to have a strong anti-war movement, nothing. And that's the basic argument.
Stanley, thank you. We're going to wind up now. I'm going to ask everybody sitting at this roundtable for their last thoughts and remind our listeners that we've been speaking with Stanley Aronowitz, who has written the book Left Turn, Forging a New Political Future. Before that, we spoke with John Ehrenberg, who wrote Servants of Wealth, The Right's Assault on Economic Justice. And then John joined us in this roundtable discussion with Stanley. And I'm going to go around the room here and ask people for their final thoughts on this. And Stanley, we're going to finish up with you as our guest for this segment. But John Ehrenberg, what are your final thoughts on this topic?
Well, I think Stanley's absolutely right in a general sense. I do think that some kind of organized political presence from outside the established political parties is just absolutely crucial. I think where I'm a little more skeptical than he is how it will be done. But Stanley, I'm going to read your book. And
you
asked me to do so, and in fairness to you, I will do so. You read mine, yeah. I will read yours.
Okay.
And Heidi, your final thoughts.
I love Stanley's ideas. I agree. I do think we have many opportunities with the internet to try to move forward on some of this. I know the National Lawyers Guild will do our best to rouse everyone else.
And Michael Ratner, do you have any final thoughts on the topic?
My only worry here is that the internet actually, I think, has a possibility of decreasing organizing and mass protest, because people think by sending in emails and reading, you know, Alternet or something, that they're doing something, when in fact, I think you want to get people into the streets, and at least that's one of my beefs with the internet.
No, I agree with you on that. The last word goes to Stanley Aronowitz, author of Left Turn. Before Stanley speaks his mind, we want to thank John Ehrenberg for coming down and being on Law and Disorder. Michael, Heidi, thank you. And Stanley, you got the last word.
Well, I wouldn't say that it's going to be an easy road, but I believe that the road has to start getting taken, because if the road is not taken, the left is going to continue to disintegrate, and part of that disintegration is due to the fact that people have been allowed by various electronic means to sit back. And I think face-to-face interaction is absolutely necessary, and I think political formation is urgent.
Thank you, Stanley.
Thanks, Stanley.
You're welcome.
We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.